Hey, everybody. Caitlin and Rebecca here. We just wanted to kick off this episode with a very tender little note up top that this conversation is a raw one. We're delving into a lot of the rough edges of in-the-moment processing of internalized ableism. So because of that, we just had a couple of notes at the top before you listen.
One thing that I want to note is I am, in this episode, grappling with a possible autism diagnosis for myself. And I am so new to this that as I'm working through a book right now about ADHD and autism, they note some language that can be like offensive or hurtful. And one of them was speaking about people with autism as on the spectrum. And I use that language a ton in this episode. And just wanted to note that I am like in real time learning. And yeah, so I just want to note for anyone that has that diagnosis or knows people that I am talking really ungracefully in this episode as I process my own experience with this as a possible diagnosis. And my language is very clunky.
And I also just want to like underscore how incredibly brave it is to hit record when you're talking about things that are new. And I think language is something we learn the more time we spend thinking and reading and learning about these things. There's even like a lot of conversation between people who claim person first language versus identity first language. So autistic person versus a person with autism. Like there's a lot of story and history and feelings and the choices of the words we use. And the first time you're trying to talk about this, it makes sense that our words would not like hit every nail on the head. So I'm glad we can give a preview to that. And then just speaking of language, I don't know what my tick is in this episode, but I talk a fair amount about postpartum depression. And I would say like 3 out of 4 times I refer to it as postpartum, which is not the same thing as postpartum depression. So just a quick note on that, that was a little silly, weird blub of mine that I insisted on over and over again in this episode inexplicably. So there's that too.
And as you might note from us needing to give so many disclaimers before we even start the episode, which I think we actually start the episode with disclaimers too, to listen with care that this is a very tender conversation between two humans about their specific experience. And if you have any kind of similar experiences with mental health, disability, postpartum depression, listen with care.
We get into some really of the ugly, hard, messy parts of this and just naming that. So not something to just dive into without any preface. So we've given our disclaimers. Okay. We hope that this conversation that we had can be as meaningful to you as it was to us. I know that we discovered a lot and it felt good to process this together. So thank you for listening.
What do you think it means to be a person?
I don't know.
Me either. Say scratch that again.
Scratch that a fan.
I'm Caitlin Metz, a non-binary illustrator and designer.
I'm Rebecca Tossig, a disabled storyteller and writer.
And this is Scratch That, Parenting and Reparenting Off Script.
A podcast for people trying to parent and person at the same time.
Head over to our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast, for show notes and a transcript of today's episode. And also to join the conversation.
Thank you for being here. Hi, friend.
Hello. Happy Monday.
We're here and jittery and nervous about this conversation we're going to have today.
Yeah, it feels like a very tender one to me. I feel super excited and also pretty naked right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we are going to hold space for this and recognize the nakedness and the vulnerability of that. We're talking about internalized ableism today, in particular, as it relates to how we show up as parents and people, I think, in all directions. I have thought about this over the course of my life, probably more than you have, and in different ways, I'm imagining, than you have. But also, I feel rather wobbly about it because having a kid really changed my experience of internalized ableism. And so what I am really excited to hear about, because you've been sort of, over the last few months, you've kind of been dropping in a few lines about how you've been talking about this in therapy, but we haven't really delved into it together yet. And I am like so eager to hear about how you're experiencing this, how it's making sense to you, how it's making you look back on past experiences differently and how you're showing up in the present. But what are the things about it that are making you feel the most nervous today?
The thing, and specifically in this moment, like recording, knowing that we will be sharing this, is that I don't know the right words to say. I'm sure that I will be clumsy and clunky. And I want deeply for everyone listening to know that I am talking about how I am moving through this right now, and preemptively apologize if I like say something really stupid. It feels tender because I'm like, oh, I don't know. For one, I don't know how to talk about it for myself because I'm just starting to grapple with this. And two, I don't want to say something in my clumsiness that would cause harm to anyone else. So that's the top layer of nervousness. And then under it is just that, like, this is kind of thrown me into left field. The things that have been coming up in therapy, and it feels tender in two ways. One is like, I don't want to misrepresent or like own things that aren't mine to own. I think that's a huge part of this for me, is being like, I don't even belong in this conversation.
I feel like a lot of people will relate to what you just said on a number of different levels. I mean, don't we all relate to that feeling of like, I don't feel like an expert in this topic and I want to talk about it and process it, but I don't know the right words. Like, I think everyone has been in a space like that. And most of us don't do that with a record button and a microphone. Like, the bravery of that is pretty enormous. So
particularly want to have this conversation with you recorded, because I think we don't have these conversations because we're unsure. We're afraid of getting it wrong. And so then we don't talk about it. And I think that is a much greater disservice than any like fumbling around that we might have.
But it's a gift that you, I feel like you're giving us, to hit the record button and have this be a conversation that we can all sort of tune into and help us process all of this for ourselves. But the other thing I think you said that I think a good number of people will relate to is that, like, not sure if I can claim this space when it comes to disability. I talk with so many folks, like when I go speaking and people come up to me afterwards and they're like, I don't think this counts. Or like, people are very quick to feel on the outside of whatever checkbox that is. And I just don't think that is terribly helpful. I come from the position of believing that ableism affects every human being, whether you have a disability or not. So like, figuring out where you are in that spectrum, I don't know if that's as helpful as just like digging into what your experience is and bearing witness to that. So I'm not thinking about that as you're talking, just so you know. But I get the feeling of that. I totally understand. And you're talking to someone who lives life from a wheelchair, and wheelchairs are the literal symbol of disability out in the world. So
it is the icon.
It is, right? The thing I would say before we, because I'm feeling a little bit nervous about talking about this too, I think for different reasons. And one of them for me is just wanting to acknowledge on the front end that like, everybody experiences this differently. Even people who have very similar disabilities, I think, can experience ableism and internalized ableism differently. And so no part of anything either of us says is like representing some universal experience. I think we're just more wanting to explore. I'm super curious about your experience and the ways that it's different than mine and the ways it overlaps with mine. So I think we're just moving into this really open-handedly, knowing like, we might be clumsy because we're like regular little people trying to figure out what this messiness is and how to move through it together. So, well, where do you think how should we dive into this?
I think we've just been dancing around. Your disability is like, it is a physical, visible disability. And I'm just going to jump in and talk about myself.
Do it.
So about a year ago, I was diagnosed with ADHD. And at first, it felt like such a relief. I felt like I could just forgive myself for so many things. And then I just started feeling angry and ashamed. And I've been processing this with my therapist deeply to the earliest ages I can remember. I have felt stupid my whole life. It's a thing that my therapist is always being like, oh, interesting. Just want to note that you called yourself stupid again. And they've just been bringing awareness to a lot of these continual themes. And with this ADHD diagnosis, I've looked back and been like, oh, these are all the ways my brain wasn't working like everyone else's. And then I just felt really dumb. And then recently, very recently, my therapist has broached the topic of me being on the spectrum, which has been really hard for me to hold. I've had a lot of resistance to it. I have realized this like deep, ugly fear inside of me of being associated with anyone who culturally would be associated with a different type of intelligence or lesser. I am like very, very, I don't know what the right words are. I'm just very sensitive to feeling. That is where I am. I'm just sitting with, and I am trying to inhale everything I can about ADHD. And also I'm dancing around, what is it? And I'm just now learning about autism outside of this like one way that it has been presented to us. And also ADHD has been presented in this one way. When I told my mom, I was like, oh, hey, I think that I have ADHD. And it was just kind of conversational. And I think she was worried that I was upset that she didn't catch it or like she didn't do something right. And I was homeschooled and given a lot of space and flexibility for my to like learn in different ways and to move my body. And so there was no reason for me to have been, you know, I don't think that it would have even really come up.
Part of what is interesting to me as you're describing this is like the different emotions that came up for you with each layer of this. So like initially feeling relief with the ADHD diagnosis, and then somehow there's a leap where that transitions into anger and shame. And then I'm also interested in how different the potential autistic diagnosis felt to you and why that might be. And it makes me wonder about what stories we have about these different diagnoses. So would you be able to speak a little bit about the different stages of emotion that, I don't know, that maybe is like an impossible question, but maybe one to just think about together is what moved you from relief to anger to shame? And why is the autism feel like a different story than the ADHD story, or what those stories might be that you have embedded in you?
The relief stemmed from like, oh, I'm not just like a lazy fuck. I'm not unmotivated. So that felt like relief. And then I started exploring stuff. And the more that I understood, the more I started realizing behaviors and patterns in my life that I have just kind of ignored, like impulsive spending or like struggling with money management. So then I just started feeling pissed off that these are things that I'm struggling with and mad at myself about it, like angry that I have ADHD, and then like ashamed that I am not doing a better job of managing it or like caring for myself. But underneath that, there is this like level of relief and just being able to be like, okay, I do just need different systems. And so that has felt supportive. And what I've reflected on, this is maybe a side tangent, but before having Charlie, I was just constantly spinning and I compensated really well. I had tons of systems. I spent so much time like organizing stuff and making things work. And I could take 10 hours a day to like do my work. And then once I had Charlie, my time was like so restricted down into when I could get things done, I lost a lot of those coping mechanisms because they were time consuming and maybe not always the most useful or productive, but I could work really, really hard. I had a friend, this was ages ago, who loves birds, and she was assigning all of us birds. And she said that I was as this little duck that looks really peaceful on top of the water, but underneath I'm just paddling like furiously. And I felt so seen in that because people often have an idea of that I'm really prolific, I'm organized, I do so many things, and they do not see the internal constant panic and struggle and that I am just racing against myself to keep up. And so that was way before this diagnosis, but that feels so true and it feels really special and also like almost violating that she was able to see me in that way. Like, how dare you read me for filth?
Oh, that's such a vivid image though, Caitlin. And the effort of that to remain like that calm little duck on top. When I talk about ableism and try to help folks understand what I see about ableism, so much of it is about like what the world is built and set up for. My definition is always like so long and layered and too clunky for a definition. But like, I always think of it as building the world around and for this, what we imagine to be the typical body and mind, which is to say a largely imagined and idealized body and mind, and leaving every other body and mind that is perceived to move, look, see, hear, process, operate, or need differently from that typical vision. It's leaving all of those other bodies and minds left scrambling, trying to figure out how they're going to keep up and fit in and survive in these systems. And what that little duck image gives to me is the picture of like how hard you're scrambling to fit into that system. And the narrative that comes with that of thinking that that is your failing. The fact that you have to strive is your failing.
Do you know what has come to me recently is around six months is when I got hit with postpartum depression. I like worked the whole, I was like working in the hospital after giving birth, but that was when I really started jumping back in and when Charlie started getting mobile. So I couldn't just work while he was strapped to me. And my therapist has been talking me through what burnout looks like, specifically like neurodivergent autistic burnout, ADHD burnout. And so much of what they describe, I wonder how much of it was actually postpartum depression and how much of it was this extreme burnout. I think what I needed was the same. So I don't think the definition of it matters that much. But I do look back at that moment as like a very distinct shift in the way that I was able to work. Because until Charlie was moving around and needing things, like I just wore him and worked. Basically, my schedule of working and producing didn't change right after I had him. And it wasn't until he started moving around and just needing me in different ways. I couldn't work and care for him simultaneously. So I don't know. That's just been really interesting.
Can we talk more about how postpartum fits into this? That is very, very interesting for me to hear you just like reflect on that in retrospect, that you, something you identified as postpartum at the time might have been something else happening. Because my experience is kind of flipped and it makes me wonder about the stories we tell and what stories are the most useful and how you interpret. I mean, like all we're doing is trying to interpret and like our brains are scrambling to figure out the narrative for our experiences. And what makes the most sense and what language we have to reach for these things. My experience of, and maybe this is part of why I feel wobbly having this conversation, because I don't know how to interpret my experience. And I still feel really wobbly in a way. I feel like I shouldn't feel so wobbly about this because before Otto was born, I felt like I had such a good handle on ableism. My book had just come out. I'd like spent 2 years like delving into all the narratives and like reclaiming them. And I felt very empowered. I felt very clear. All of the metaphors I'm thinking of are like body metaphors. I felt very sturdy, I should say. And even through pregnancy, I felt really good about the intersection of parenting and disability. I loved the symbolism that my body was holding on to, of like this big pregnant belly on top of a wheelchair. Like all of that was working for me. And then when Otto was born, I just started drowning very quickly, and I still kind of struggled to parse out what all of the pieces were. I mean, Otto was just like cried all the time as a baby. He really struggled to sleep. He still struggles to sleep. It was just like a really challenging time. And some of that was tied up in my body. Like, I've talked before about how, like, I couldn't soothe him the way Micah's body could soothe him. He hated being in wraps. You know, like, I had always pictured us just, like, moving through the world in wraps, and he would just, like, bite them. And that felt like, I think if we had been able to figure those pieces out better, it wouldn't have felt like so directly targeted at my body. But I really started to develop a narrative in my head that, like, I had been wrong about what I imagined disability and motherhood, or like parenting, to the possibilities of it. I'd been wrong about it. And actually, like, I was not equipped to do this. I felt like a failure. And my interpretation of that feeling was that I should feel like a failure because I was a failure. And so all of this was sort of like being absorbed through the lens of like my inadequacies because of my body. And it got really bad. And I think part of the reason we have those narratives, that we internalize those narratives to begin with, is because they're very real in the world around us, right? Like, ableism is happening in a million tiny and enormous ways all the time. So you're like in this new wobbly role and it's hard. And then you look out at the world around you and everyone's like, no, you shouldn't be doing this. Like, I remember when we would take Otto to his doctor's appointments. Our hospital has like a valet who stands in front of the building. And every single time I brought Otto to the hospital, which is a lot when they're little, this valet, it was the same valet, and she would stand at the front of the hospital and she would glare at me, like scowl at me from the moment I left the parking garage, as I crossed the street, as I like pushed myself up the sidewalk to the front door. She was just like waiting for me to drop him or something. I mean, it was just like she was laser focused on me, like her head turning around to watch me go into this hospital. And I remember it made me afraid to take him to the doctor. I was just like, I know what to expect. Someone is going to be skeptical of me when I show up here. And I remember holding Otto in my lap, kissing the top of his head, just thinking like, people don't trust me. People don't feel like I should be doing this. And maybe they're right, like really internalizing that narrative. And so what made me think of what you were describing is that it got to be really bad, I think, when Otto was about 9 months old. You know, maybe people can fast forward a minute or so. This might be like a content warning for people, especially those who maybe have experienced internalized ableism as a parent. But it was really bad when Otto was about 9 months old. And I remember I was like sitting on the toilet in the bathroom, and I remember watching Micah give Otto a bath, and they just looked like a commercial for baby soap or something. They just looked like so happy and complete and perfect. And I remember thinking like, oh, they would be so much better off if I was not here, if I was gone. They would be so much better off, and really believing that. And it was maybe like 2 years later that I had a therapist say like, I think maybe you were experiencing postpartum, but there was no part of my brain that interpreted anything I was feeling that way. I did not see any of it through that lens. I think that disability is a really easy scapegoat. And so I think the flip of my experience from yours might be that all of the things that maybe somebody else could have identified as like, girl, you need to get some help. This isn't, your brain is like lying to you, or like your body is experiencing this in a way that is harmful and we need to intervene. I was just like, no, this is the dirty secret. I can't tell anyone. And nobody can know that actually I'm like, I shouldn't be doing this. And I need to keep pretending like I can. And I need to prove that I can. And I didn't talk to anybody about it except Micah sometimes. Anyways, I think it's interesting that you are like, maybe that wasn't postpartum. Maybe that was neurodivergent burnout. And I'm like, maybe that wasn't my body's fault. Maybe that was postpartum depression. And I don't know what to do with that like little mirror image, if that's useful for us to pay attention to.
One thing my therapist and I have been talking about is, what is the difference between all these things? And in what context does it matter? And in which context does it not? Because I have depression, I have anxiety, I have complex PTSD. And now I'm like, and I have ADHD, and maybe I'm also on the spectrum? And what does this mean? And which one is which? Or am I deeply, I'm like, am I just a lazy fucking idiot? Am I just inherently stupid? Am I just unable to do things? Am I just a lazy slob? But I think that that is where it's like, was it postpartum depression? Was it burnout? I think they all contribute. When I was pregnant, I would have all these nightmares where someone took Charlie from me. I like really couldn't believe that he was going to be mine. And that I think is deeply rooted in that I have really cared for and loved a lot of children. And some of them I thought were going to be mine in like legal custody ways. And they weren't mine. And I watched a lot of children be harmed that I cared for a lot and was just, there was nothing I could do to protect them. I just couldn't believe that he was going to be my, that someone wouldn't take him from me. And during that time, pregnancy brought up so much gender stuff. I feel like I had worked through like the sexuality piece through like my 20s and into my 30s. That felt solid. But the gender portion of my experience of queerness was, it was unescapable. I couldn't not pay attention to it. And I think we talked about this, maybe we talked about in one of our early episodes that never even came to be, but when I would take him to the pediatrician, I would just change clothes over and over again. Because when I was looking at myself, I did not look like the image of what a mom, quote unquote, looked like. And trans bills were being passed. And there was a lot of things happening politically that just made me feel scared to be openly queer or to not identify as a woman. And totally different context, but those feelings feel so visceral to me. And just the amount of times I would look in the mirror and be like, how do I wear something that I feel really good and sturdy in? And also that I make sure everyone around me knows that I am the parent and I am a good parent and that I can do this. I just had so much fear about him being taken away from me.
What I hear us talking about is like trust and whether or not people trust us to be parents. And I think feeling like we need to prove that we're trustworthy or that we can be responsible for the care of these little people that we love more than the universe, like that puts us in a position of defensiveness or like internalizing that and not trusting ourselves. And I think that if people are genuinely concerned about the care that a child is receiving, I think that the thing we do is support that parent, not put a script in their head that they can't do it and they're not capable. Because I think that like parents need to be supported and equipped, not given a story of their inadequacies. Oh, and it reminds me, this does remind me of this quote. I was talking to you about Easy Beauty, my Chloe Cooper Jones, and some of the ways that she writes about being a disabled parent to her son. And one of the lines that stood out to both of us on page 216, and this is after a scene where Chloe Cooper Jones' son runs away from her and a stranger has to grab him and bring her back to him. And he makes her feel really ashamed for not being capable of running after him, I guess. And then in this section, she talks about like the things that her doctor told her or would said to her when she was pregnant about like, this pregnancy is dangerous for you and your child. What if he's born like you? What if he runs out into the street and you can't protect him? Your body could endanger his. Like all of these things that are building up to a narrative. At the end of this scene, she writes, when I was pregnant, the perceived dangers that accompanied my body were all anyone talked to me about. No one was worried enough about how my mind could limit him. And what that makes me think is that people are unaware of the power of narrative and how a doctor or that stranger contributing to this narrative that she can't do this and she's not capable of doing this is actually just as if not more harmful than any physical danger. But I wonder how that plays out for you, because the difference between us here is that I absorbed this ableist narrative my whole life, and it disempowered me in feeling like I could be a parent and that I actually could do this job. I don't know how that works on your end. Like, you didn't at least like consciously have that narrative put upon you, but maybe you felt it in other ways. Like, when you think about it as internalized ableism, do you see yourself as having some kind of script around that? And does that affect how you parent? Or is that not the language or the framework that we would think about it in for you?
The idea of internalized ableism has just come to me, mostly because my therapist keeps pointing it out, because we will talk about a possible diagnosis and I will talk about how I feel about it. And they will say, that's valid. Also, no shame, but sounds like internalized ableism.
Okay. So the biggest part of that internalized ableism is around diagnosis, you would say?
I think so. As I'm understanding it right now in the very middle of it, it almost always comes back to either shame or anger at myself. Like feeling like I'm not doing a good enough job, that I'm not valid, that I should be doing something better, should be able to handle things easier. I feel very distressed about how much, in order for me to not burn out or to fall into the dark place, in order for my mental health to remain steady, I need a lot of supports, and I am mad about it. And I feel embarrassed about it, and I don't want it to be true. And I deeply believe that I'm just like, don't have enough gumption or something.
And how does the diagnosis fit into that?
Because if the diagnosis is true, it's true that I need this help. And it's not just, then I have to accept that I'm not just a fuck. And I have to accept that I actually do have these limitations. And it's much easier for me to just be pissed off at myself and to think, to like try harder and say that I should just do better, instead of me saying, no, I can't do this thing because my well-being is contingent upon this amount of rest, this amount of alone time. No, this activity is actually very triggering to me and I can't come do this thing.
So the diagnosis means that you actually can't, or that you're not going to white knuckle it anymore, that you have to like actually make changes, and changes are really hard.
Yep. And I feel very upset about it, like really, really upset. And that is the piece that my therapist has been saying, this sounds like internalized ableism, that you can't see yourself as a whole, productive, valid human in the world, and while accepting these limitations or needs or supports. And on the flip side, I'm going through this book that's changing my life, I think. It's called The Neurodivergent Skills Workbook for Autism and ADHD. And I'm like crying because they're naming things like the impact that your environment can have on you, or how lighting impacts you. And it's like really validating to know that other people experience that. And it also really pisses me off that I'm in the category of people who need so much care. And I don't feel that way about other people. I just don't want to be the other people. And that, I think, is this like kind of really ugly, fucked up. I've been acknowledging that there is an ugly piece in me that I'm like, oh, maybe I am actually judging those people, or maybe there is a hidden belief. Because on the outside, I think that it's not how I move through the world that I would judge anyone who needs support and really advocate for their support. Yeah. So it feels all tangled. It feels all tangled and kind of ugly.
Well, it's interesting to like pull apart the different feelings that you have around that, because on the one hand, it is really annoying to have to arrange anything extra. That takes time and energy, and it's frustrating to have to not be able to flow inside the default that's already been there. And that takes effort and energy and time, and maybe asking people for help, and all of that can be annoying. But that's different than not feeling like a whole person because you need to do those things. Would I be right to say that both of those things are true for you? That like the annoyance part is part of it, and then the other part of it is like, and also I'm not a whole, or I'm a lesser kind of person.
And there's a third piece that is like, I am making this up. I'm just being a whiny baby. And also, like, no one's going to believe that this is real, and they're going to think that you're just like, everyone on TikTok has autism now. I mean, I've not been officially assessed for that, and I don't necessarily know that that is a diagnosis that I'm claiming for myself yet. And there's also, like, you know, my capital S self who's regulated and been in therapy for so long. And I can also be like, wow, this is really validating to have these diagnoses. I truly believe that, like, everyone deserves support. I believe that everyone, including me, is, like, whole and valid, even if they have, you know, but there are these very big other parts of myself that I'm very enmeshed with that do not hold that. And so when I, you know, I could talk about this too from my, like, regulated higher self, which is also there and exists, but it's harder for me to access that part of myself.
Yeah, like for most of us, I think, at least a sewer rat like me. You know?
Interrupting this episode to say thank you to everyone supporting the podcast on Patreon.
We love seeing your comments come through. We love getting to know each of you better. Like, you being there really means the world to us.
If you want to support the project financially, you can become a paying patron for as low as $5 a month. That's less than a latte.
But there's lots of free ways to support the podcast too. Sharing episodes, giving us one of those very pretty 5-star reviews, all of that makes a huge difference too.
And you can also join Patreon without paying. So the show notes will always be there for you. Okay, back to the show.
I have another question for you. Do you believe that most people do fit rather easily and naturally into the systems and structures that run our world?
It's hard for me to conceptualize. I have really thought that the way that I experience the world is normal. And I also surround myself with a lot of narrow, spicy people. And so I think that's where the belief comes that I'm just not working hard enough, because it's hard for me to believe that anyone feels differently. But then sometimes around people, and I'm like, oh my God, you are neurotypical and none of these things are hard for you. You just wash your clothes and you remember to take it out of the washer and put it in the dryer, and then you fold it and you put it away.
I don't do that. Who does that?
No, a number of other things. Or like, you don't start 15 projects and then end them and you don't impulsively. But then I just think that they're more disciplined than I am. So it is hard for me to conceptualize of anyone who fits well into this system.
Yeah. And also, it seems like some people do.
Some people do.
I just was speaking for the Center for Disability Inclusion and, like, talking to people afterwards. One of the things that I talked about in that talk was the way that it was so uncomfortable for any part of the world around me to have to bend or to accommodate my body, that what I did was try to make myself smaller so that I could sort of, like, fit into that flow a little bit better without making any disruptions to it. And I was talking to this guy afterward who I think had an invisible disability, who was saying he went his whole life making himself smaller, feeling kind of awful all the time, thinking that that was just, like, his place in the world. And then he started a disability affinity group, his work, and suddenly all of these people that he worked with were coming to that, showing up, and he was like, holy shit, I'm not the only one who's been feeling this way. All these people that I thought were fine are not fine. And, like, we're all, like, having this great reckoning together. Like, oh, this has taken a toll on me. Oh, I've been carrying this extra weight. I'm the duck paddling furiously to keep up. And I didn't realize there were other ducks out here, like, furiously trying to keep up. I didn't know. I do wonder about that a little bit. If you're naming something that more people around you, not to say that there aren't those people out there that keep up with their laundry and they stay on top of the tasks or whatever. But, like, I wonder if there are more people around you than you know, and we don't feel safe to name it. We think that it's our own personal failing. And I don't know, it's a little bit like the emperor has no clothes on thing, where, like, suddenly once we all say, I don't know. Not, and I don't want to imply that, like, it's not like everybody is experiencing the same thing. it's not like everyone is a duck that is pedaling the same way that you are. It's just, I think that more of us are carrying an extra toll that we don't.
Well, I look at, there's a lot of assessments that ask questions like if something is inhibiting your ability to like do your work or school. Well, like that is a marker. And I'm like, who the fuck out here is coping with that? Well, but it's like, if you can't measure up to this capitalist society that we have built, and if you can't fully function in it, then there's a thing wrong with you.
Yeah.
Which I think is inaccurate.
I think part of it is like, this is where it gets into like the blurry lines of the importance of the category of like, you fit into this checkbox of disability or you don't. I mean, I tend to think that like a lot of us are suffering by the structures and systems around us. A lot of us are struggling to fit into the systems at work and school. And some of that is because of a diagnosis or a disability that we have. I think there's a spectrum of how far outside of that, or some of us are pedaling really hard to try to keep up and fit in, and we're kind of managing, but it's not really working. Some of us can't even do that paddling and we're not fitting in and it doesn't work at all. And some of us, I think, are paddling harder and maybe don't have that disability or that diagnosis, but we're still feeling the strain of a system that was not made for actual human beings with actual human bodies and minds, and was designed for like this machine cog, which very few of us fit into. I think the way that our world is set up is that in some ways it demands that we fit into that checkbox, because that's the only way you can have accommodations and they can make a workaround for you to try to fit into that system. But I think that it is a system that doesn't work for most people. And so,
and no one is just, well, maybe not no one, that's such a big word, but people move in and out of ability and disability. The way that I experienced pregnancy was very disabling.
Yeah.
And the year after, very disabling. When I think about if we're going to have another kid or not, it's like, are we in a place where I am going to knowingly, willingly take on the disability? I am just unable to produce and move through the world in the same ways. I require a lot of accommodating.
And dare I say that the country that you and I live in, I think, participates in making pregnancy a disabling experience. Because I think of disability as so much as an experience. It's like you have a particular body and a particular mind, and either there is an ecosystem or an environment where it is easy to move through the world with that body or mind, or where it is a struggle to move through the world. I mean, that's a little oversimplification, but that's the general idea. And we live in a country where, like, you have a baby and there's no guarantee that you will have any space to tend to your body or that brand new infant with any security. I think that is creating a disabling experience around pregnancy.
Yeah. And this brings the intersection of economic status and then layer race on top of that. Like, there's so many layers, but when I look around at some people who seem to have it a little easier, I'm like, is their brain functioning better, or do they just have the resources to pay for a house cleaner? Do they have paid leave while they have their baby? Like, am I just so prone to postpartum depression, or did I just not have any space to recover and give my body and mind what it needs to restore itself after the immense thing of giving birth? Or just bringing a kid into your home, just how much that interrupts or unsettles the equilibrium of your home ecosystem and how little supports there are for that.
Well, because I'm thinking about the way that you described the coping that you did before Charlie was here, was having like all of that time. And there are setups that folks have where they have a brand new baby and they still have that time because they are able to afford all of the supports. People who have night nurses and can sleep at night and then have care during the day, that's just a fundamentally different experience, and it creates a different experience for your body and for your mind. It's complicated. So I am curious also about if we were processing like these new layers of internalized ableism that you are wondering what's happening and how to interpret it, Do you find that that feels like it affects the way that you show up as a parent or the way you interact with Charlie at all?
I think I have less now than I did in the beginning, but I worry a lot about how my mental health will impact him. I grew up with a parent who had a lot of mental health challenges, and much of all of any negative behavior or bad outcome was associated with that diagnosis versus just not owning stuff or struggling in other areas. And so the way that I am moving through that, I feel really comfy with the depression, anxiety, complex PTSD. I mean, I've had years to process that, years of therapy around it. I've experienced this my entire life. I'm very conscious of the ways that that might impact Charlie. And we talk about feelings all the time. And as soon as I feel like I am not in a place where I can parent well, I throw out a flag and I call in a support so that I am never making my mental health his problem. And I say that as though I never do it. I do it all the time. And I apologize and we repair. And I'm just constantly owning my shit. So that is how those two things, that's how I have been approaching those. And in the beginning, when the depression, anxiety was so debilitating, and I would read studies about how like eye contact, if you're disassociated, you're not making the same kind of eye contact and how like harmful that is to your baby. That shit really fucked me up because I was very concerned. But now I feel much sturdier in that I feel very like open and it feels relatively easy for me to talk about the challenges and the things that I need in regards to anxiety and depression and the complex PTSD. The ADHD part feels tricky because that feels like I'm just like fucking up basic adult being a person stuff. And I like really struggle to like create structure for Charlie. And I know that he could probably benefit from it. And we lead this really loosey-goosey world. And I feel really bad about the fact that I'm struggling to instill good like dental hygiene for him because I just like forget stuff. So those feel a little hard.
Wait, when you say those, you mean
ADHD specifically? I haven't even thought about how autism would impact or like what that actually means. But actually, those things don't feel... I've thought so much about how to parent with mental health challenges. And I think about it a lot.
Yeah, it's clear. That's obvious.
And that doesn't mean that I feel good or fine about it.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm not answering the question.
I mean, it's a hard question.
It definitely impacts how I parent. I make very strategic decisions based on that. My highest priority is emotional intelligence, repair, being really honest about when I fuck something up, when I'm grumpy, when always trying to view us as equal, full humans, and never being like blaming my bad behavior or me yelling or like handling a situation in ways that don't feel congruent with my values as his fault because of his behavior. Always owning my own behavior. And I think that is a positive impact on my parenting.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So like one thing that stands out to me in like the way that you talk about your own family of origin and saying like having a parent with mental health issues, and maybe it sounds like for some of your life, you interpreted that mostly as being about like that mental health diagnosis being at fault there, which I think is really common. I mean, that's why I've said this before on this episode of like disability being a really easy scapegoat. And I think that historically, there's a lot of momentum behind the story, the narrative that disabled parents are unfit automatically. And what I really like in what you described there is it's like you are taking away that like one-to-one dimension and saying like, because I have these mental health things, therefore I've lost the game before I start because it makes me unfit. You're very intentional with everything surrounding the reality that you live in and kind of what you know about yourself. Because to me, I think a much more helpful story for all parents, like literally all parents, is instead of like having a category of fit or unfit parent, it's like every single parent is operating through a system of limits and assets. Every single one. And there's a different sort of little dynamic in each pairing. And if we were like to approach it that way and look at how do I amplify and make the most of my assets? And how do I like mitigate and manage the limitations? That seems like such a more empowering script for all of us than just like, well, this is something about you that sucks and is going to harm your kid in some way. You know, I mean, like there's things about all of our family systems or all of the ways that we're doing this have limitation.
It makes me think about the conversation we had with Alex, episode 3, where Alex is talking about how much she needs support in her home and that doesn't feel like a failure to her. It feels like building community. And the way that she is has so accepted what her needs are and is fulfilling them in really nourishing ways. And I think that's where the place that I am with this ADHD and autism diagnosis is that I am not ready to accept the limitations and needs. And that is where it feels sticky and hard and impossible. I have fully accepted my needs, maybe not fully, but I have a lot of acceptance for PTSD, anxiety, depression. And I've spent my entire adult life learning and processing and paying thousands and thousands of dollars to go to therapy and understand this part of myself so that I don't cause harm to others because of the things that I'm struggling with. And I have built a lot of magical, beautiful things for myself. I wrote a whole fucking book about it. And so I've transformed that. And so I do feel like that will come with these other diagnoses. But right now, in the moment that I am, I'm pissed off. I'm embarrassed. You know, I haven't accepted it. I don't know it's embarrassing for me to say all the things that I need and to build those supports. And I'm working through it. I know enough to know that we'll come to the other side. But in this spot, it feels like shit.
Not to like go against what your therapist is saying. I don't know what your therapist would say about what I'm about to say. But like, I think it makes sense for there to be a certain amount of resistance because that is hard work. I mean, like that takes a lot of effort and feeling yourself sort of like steel against like, I mean, like, you know, the amount of work and time that you put into like processing and building a different sort of world around these other diagnoses that you have, like it's a lot of work. It's really hard. And I think it makes sense that somebody wouldn't be like, woohoo, can't wait to tackle this project. You know, like it's hard. But I think it's also pretty great that you have the firsthand experience and the inner knowing that like on the other side of this, these pains could be the portal to something really, really great.
Yeah. And I think that my therapist is like, they are very present for that. But I think the only way for me to understand this resistance is to understand how I am internalizing. I think acknowledging this, I referred to it as this ugly part earlier, but I'm just like noticing things that I don't really like about myself and the way that I think about other people and the way that I think about perceived intelligence and who I'm just like, I'm uncovering some things within me that I would not want to own publicly. And I very much want to shift the stories that I hold, but they're still there and they're really real. And yeah, I'm really glad that I have someone who has compassion for that and makes a lot of space for me to say like some pretty fucked up shit and to be called out on it really gently.
Well, it makes sense that you have those stories in you, Caitlin, because that's the air we breathe. And so the fact that you're noticing them has got to be like one of the biggest hurdles in doing something about all of that, right? Like,
well, I think that's what we do is we pretend that we're not racist, we're not ableist, we're not, until you like look at the stories that are like in your body. And of course, my capital S self, I think it's easy for us to be like, I don't actually believe that. I have. And it's like, okay, sure. And also, there are these little gremlins. Notice, like, just like sit with that dark, the thing that feels ugly that you want to pretend doesn't exist there. That's what I'm in the midst of right now, is looking at the parts of myself that I don't really, I'm not very proud of. And separating that from the worth and value and good intention that I like are intrinsically a part of me, and like holding both of those at the same time.
I think we should talk about this in 6 months and do an internalized ableism part two. I'm super eager to hear about how this evolves for you.
I think that I would love as well to do a book report on this workbook. I've just started it. My therapist is going on leave. I'm just going to dedicate this episode to them. They're going on medical leave for 6 weeks. And so I'm pausing therapy for 6 weeks, which I have not done in years, been without a therapist. So I'm working through this book and I've created a whole project for myself where I'm exploring a lot of these needs that I have. And I'm hoping that I come back to our sessions with like a new understanding. And it's really forcing me to like sit with this myself, which I think is really important for me right now. I have backup therapists on speed dial. Like I am tending to myself carefully in this time, but I'm really excited to like dive into this because as uncomfortable and vulnerable and messy as it feels, I know that there's something juicy in here and that there's something on the other side. And so I'm also like,
I know that it's like not fair to not have to do any of this work myself and to sit here and like say anything, but I do feel like if there was ever anyone that would move through this project, more sparkles around them in the air and just like figure it out in a way that feels sustainable and sturdy and exciting and whimsical, it would be you. I do feel like you're up for it, but I'm sorry about the extra toll of it. And I wish that the world was already set up more to bring you more ease than it does now and the systems and the default scripts.
Well, I wish that for you as well. Like you have, I feel like we've focused on me a lot of this, but you have been walking this journey your whole life in really visible ways. Cause I can not, people at the grocery store are not commenting or like seeing this part of me, unless I'm having a full-on meltdown, which has happened. But, you know, I can hide this and talk about it when I feel sturdy and with the people that I want to. And so that is something that not everyone has the privilege of.
It's just this different set of pieces, you know? In some ways, I think that when your disability is so physical and visible, that in some ways, I don't know if easier is the right word, but like it makes a little bit more sense to the world that you need a different setup, you know, like, and I don't know if that turns into like skepticism when you go to someone and say, I need to do this differently, or I need an extra tool or support, or if it's, I don't know, easier, maybe some of us with physical and invisible disabilities start processing this earlier because we're forced to, and there's the benefit of that and the detriment of that, you know, like, I don't know. It's just a whole different set of pieces.
Yeah. And there's not really a hierarchy.
I was like presenting an award to someone for their book. I chose this beautiful book, nonfiction book, to win this prize in Kansas. I like presented the award and stuck around for the whole ceremony. And then as I was leaving, this woman came up and put her arms around my shoulders and her face right up to my face. And she said, tell me you're not stuck in that thing. And I said, well, no, like I'm not stuck in it. And she was like, oh, thank God. And I said, no, I mean, like I use it every day. I rely on it every day. And she was just like, oh, well, I don't know the political things to say. And like, it turned into this whole big, messy, awkward thing. And then a former professor of mine was there for the whole thing and like saw it happen. It was really uncomfortable. And it was mostly hilarious to me. I was like, there's like little weird microaggressions, and then there's just spilling all over the place, like messiness. And I was giggling to myself, but she said, my professor was like, you should really read Rebecca's book. It's called Sitting Pretty. And this woman kept trying to Google it, and she kept saying, instead of sitting pretty, she kept saying still pretty. I was dying. It was so...
What a Freudian slip.
It was, yeah, it was the best and the worst. I think a moment like that probably would have thrown me more when I was younger. And it's mostly hilarious to me now. But I think that the tiny prick point pang of it is like, oh, is this like how a lot of people see me out in the world and they're just not messy enough to spill it out onto me while they hold onto my shoulders? And it goes back to narrative and just that idea of this is a sad body, or this is a neutral body, or this is an incompetent body. I think that is part of the dance when you have a visible physical disability, is just the immediate narrative that people have for your body. And then that's a lot to negotiate with. And once you bring a kid into that, Lord, I'm just feeling the weight of that on my chest a little bit right now. It is a lot to carry someone's narrative on your body. But then when it expands over to cover your relationship with your child, it's a little breathtaking. So still pretty.
Still pretty.
Good stuff. That's my next book.
Still. Dedicated to the woman who hugged me. And God, that makes me think about the way that people come up to children and babies and just feel like they can touch them. You're not a real person. Or like, if you're a kid, it's like, I can say anything to you or like come up to you. There's this like open invitation. And it just feels like disability can makes it where people just see you as a child or something. And that
public, like we all have the right to interact in any way that we want. And yeah. What would we like to invite people on Patreon to engage in? I mean, I think one of the things that came out for us in this conversation is some of those unique textures of our own journey is a cheesy word, but like our own journey with ableism and internalized ableism and the ways that that is, I think, quite different for us in a lot of ways. And I would be curious to know other people's particular experiences with that, the things that make their own experience specific around ableism and internalized ableism.
Yeah, maybe where they identified with the things that we said or what was completely different for them. I feel like as we're having this conversation, I'm understanding so many things. But what stood out to me was me really understanding how I'm in a different place with these new diagnoses than I am with past ones. And I don't think that I really had fully conceptualized until we were just talking now that I will move through this. And this is actually a beautiful part of the process. I feel like that is everything I was saying today feels like, oh, I just realized this. But like, where are people in this process themselves? Can they see the arc of like, and honoring all of those places that we can talk about this before we get to the part where we fully accept ourselves and fully accept everyone else and we don't have any like ugly, messy bits about us?
I also wonder if there are folks who didn't realize that what they were experiencing was internalized ableism. I think one of the things that's tricky about internalized ableism is that it doesn't, I think I said this earlier, but it's like, I feel like a failure because I am a failure, right? Not because this is something I've internalized, a narrative that I've taken on. It's like, oh, wait a minute, that's a narrative. So that could be interesting too. Yeah, I'm curious how people are, what's landing and what they're processing as they listen to us unpack this together.
Okay. Well, join us over on Patreon and add to the conversation.
Caitlin, thank you for being willing to be open about the mess of all of that. And we're going to have to talk about this again because this will be evolving.
Yeah. Thank you for being someone that I can just come with all of the messy parts. I feel like I realized some things today about this as we were talking that I didn't understand before. And that feels really good. So I'm very excited to see what a conversation about this in like 6 months.
Me too. It reminds me of that grief is a door idea that we talk about in the episode about should we have another baby? Like there's some grief or some anger or frustration. And what if that's the door that moves you into this next thing? And hard work, not going to minimize the hard work, but worth it.
Ooh, the last thing I want to say is there were two accounts that were really supportive of me when I was walking through this. And we'll put this in the show notes. But Andy J. Pizza, who runs Creative Pep Talk podcast, talks so much about his experience of ADHD. And then Domestic Blisters on TikTok, Casey Davis. She has a podcast called Struggle Care and a book called How to Keep House While Drowning. And the way that she has talked about her experience of neurodivergence and parenting has given me so much permission to even consider seeking out diagnosis or even bringing this up in therapy. And then The Electricity of Every Living Thing. And we'll list all those by Catherine May.
I don't know that one.
So good. We should do a book report. It is her journey to uncovering that she has autism. And yeah, I cried through that book. The Electricity of Every Living Thing.
And then are we going to have these available on our bookshop where people can buy the books and then support the show?
Yes, I'll add them and we'll link directly to those in the show notes.
All right. I love you.
Okay, love you.
Thank you, everybody. All right. Bye.
You tell me when we're done, okay?
This podcast is edited and perfected by Amelia of Softer Sounds.
For all the show notes and a transcript of today's episode, check out our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast. This is our hub. It's where you can join the conversation and be part of our community.
If today's episode resonated with you or made you think of someone, share it.
And if you want to support the pod and also make us glow inside, go give a 5-star review on Apple. That would be so lovely.
Thank you for being here, for listening, for being a part of this community.
We love you so much.